If you've ever studied game theory, you may have heard of a dilemma known as the prisoner's dilemma. It's a paradox, whereby two guilty defendants engage in individualized decision-making that does not produce optimal results. Here's Presh Talwalkar explaining the dilemma.
Let's discuss the prisoner's dilemma. You and your partner in crime have been apprehended by the police. The officer explains they don't have much evidence, and if you both hold out, then you will each serve 1 year in jail. The officer wants you both to confess, in which case you'll serve 2 years in jail each. He also explains that if only one of you confesses, that person goes free, and the other will serve 4 years in jail as a penalty for holding out. He separates you and your partner, and you think about it. If you could trust your partner and you both held out, then you'd only serve 1 year in jail. However, if your partner confesses and you don't, then you will serve 4 years as a penalty for holding out. That doesn't sound very good, so you think about it logically. If your partner confesses, then you'll serve 4 years in jail for holding out, but only 2 years for confessing. On the other hand, if your partner holds out as well, then you'll serve 1 year in jail for holding out, and you'll go free if you confess. Clearly, confessing is less jail time for you, no matter what your partner does. Your partner goes through a similar calculus and realizes confessing is better for him no matter what you do. So in the end, you both confess to the crime and serve 2 years in jail. And that's the strange part, because if you had both held out, you would have only served 1 year in jail each. The prisoner's dilemma is a conflict between doing what's best for yourself as an individual and considering the group and what might be best for the group.
The prisoner's dilemma explains why guilty defendants often turn on their accomplices, and also why individuals threatened with charges often falsely implicate innocent individuals. I believe the case of Cyrus Wilson is an example of the prisoner's dilemma, but I also believe it's an example of another dilemma that pervades the American criminal justice system, the innocent prisoner's dilemma. Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. Today's special undisclosed episode is about the case of Cyrus Wilson, who was arrested days after his 18th birthday in 1992 for a Nashville murder he's been saying he didn't commit for the past 27 years.
We know personally, we know Joe. Cyrus and Joe were at Riverbend together for years, so, we watched his little boy, grow up from the time he was born until Joe got moved. And so, it's when I see Joe, I'm like, it always strikes me because I'm like, when Cyrus told me about his case, I was like, oh my goodness. Nashville has been rough. And I never thought that before. I thought Cyrus was an anomaly.
So what's Cyrus Wilson's story? Back on July 20th, 1992, Cyrus was a 17-year-old young man who was driving a white 1968 Chevy Bel Air near the Edge Hill Housing Projects in South Nashville, Tennessee. At about 10:15 p.m., he was robbed of the car at gunpoint by Christopher Luckett, who was known by the name Crip because of the partial loss of use of his right arm after a car accident. What do you remember about Christopher Luckett taking your car at gunpoint?
I was in my aunt's car, and I had pulled up, and it's like he called me to the breezeway. And then calling me to the breezeway, he drew a gun on me. In my neighborhood, the way the apartments were set up is like you go into like the middle of the apartment, and like there's a staircase that leads straight up to the middle section, and then like there's another staircase that leads up to the top section. And so he had like called me, because I knew him. I didn't know him well, like we weren't friends or anything, but I didn't know him. Like, we went to school together. He was from my neighborhood. Not from my neighborhood, but we went to school together. He was from not my neighborhood, but, like, a neighborhood that was in the vicinity of mine while we went to school together. So, I'm familiar with him. So, him calling me to the breezeway didn't seem like, something for me to worry about.
Right. But then you meet up with him, and what ends up happening?
Well, he pulls a gun on me and tells me don't run, and or he's going to shoot me. Did ask for my keys, and I mean, that was pretty much it.
A few days later, Nashville police recovered the car, but it had been stripped of its wheels, stereo system, and something else. Here's Cyrus Wilson. So this is this is the 1968 Chevy Bel Air, right, that was stolen from
exactly.
you. And what was so what was the condition of that car when you got it back?
The torsion bars had been broken, so the car was not drivable, which is why it was at my aunt's house, because I couldn't leave it at my apartment complex.
Next, fast forward to September 15th, 1992. At about midnight, Christopher Luckett was fatally shot. When police officers responded to the 911 calls, they found his body partially wedged under a chain-link fence by his housing project, dead from a shotgun wound to the face. Near Luckett's body, they recovered empty shotgun shells, shotgun wadding, and a blue duffel bag. According to the state, because it was 1992 and it was a rainy night, they never tested the evidence they collected for fingerprints or DNA. And according to the state, the morning after the murder, Detective Bill Pridemore approached 13-year-old Marquise Harris, who lived in the neighborhood where Luckett was shot. According to Pridemore and Harris at trial, on September 25th, Harris saw Luckett coming toward the chain-link fence when he tried to jump it. Then, Harris saw Cyrus Wilson pull out a sawed-off shotgun and shoot at Luckett 3 times. After this, the case against Cyrus Wilson proceeded pretty quickly. A few days after the murder, and a few days after his 18th birthday, Cyrus Wilson voluntarily went to the police station.
I wasn't arrested. I went to the police station. Like, I was never arrested. They didn't pick me up. They called my house with my cousin on the phone, talking about they knew I did it, they knew I killed somebody, and they wanted me to come to talk to them. So I went and talked to them. Like, I didn't have anything to hide. There was no reason for me not to go.
At the station, Wilson told the same story he's been telling for the past 27 years.
I think initially we were out on the basketball court. It's hard to explain. I know I say that to people and they're like, what does that mean? But in my apartment complex, there was like a basketball court that we all kind of hung out at. It was really like where, you know, guys sold drugs. It was kind of a spot for, you know, illicit activities, actually. But, I mean, that's where we kind of did our thing, whether it's kids or whatever. Like, that's the kind of neighborhood it was. And, I mean, I was just there, like, kind of hanging out. I do recall when we heard the gunshot. I'm sure it may have been two. I'm not sure, but I can just really recall kind of one. I don't remember, two. But, I mean, you know, obviously people get alarmed and say, like, okay, somebody's shooting and trying to see what's going on. You know, people kind of get, you know, start to, you know, see. I don't know, I keep saying, you know, because I'm trying to, I mean, it's hard to make people understand when you live in the hood how things kind of operate. But, you know, people realize they're shooting. Like, people don't really panic or freak out. Some people, you know, do. Some people don't. I chose at that moment to take my buddy to the house. I did. I called my girlfriend. She was like, what's up? I was like, you know, you coming down here, whatever. She said she was coming.
At trial, Lasonya Roberson, the girl who Cyrus Wilson had been dating, would testify in his defense. According to Roberson, she arrived home about 15 minutes before the shooting, and Cyrus called her to hang out 5 minutes later. And then, Roberson, who lived just above Cyrus, came right down and listened to music with Cyrus and made out with him late into the night. Given the distance between the location of the shooting and Cyrus Wilson's apartment, this was a pretty solid alibi, even in the absence of defense counsel calling alibi witnesses who might have seen Cyrus in the basketball court at the time of the shooting. But it didn't matter. In addition to Marquise Harris, the state presented the testimony of 16-year-old Rodriguez Lee. Lee testified that on September 25th, he saw Cyrus Wilson chasing Christopher Luckett, with Luckett eventually getting stuck under a fence. According to Lee, Cyrus then pulled a sawed-off shotgun out of a duffel bag and pointed at Lee, who begged, "Please don't kill me," before Cyrus shot him in the face. And the state also presented the testimony of Frederick Davis, another teenager, who testified that Cyrus said he was going to get Christopher Luckett because he had stolen his car.
You know, we all have those guilty pleasures that we like to hide away from the rest of the world because you just want to keep it all for yourself, like, you know, candy in your office drawer. Well, one of my guilty pleasures that I like to be only all mine is my FabFitFun boxes. When I get one of my FabFitFun boxes, and, you know, for those of you who may not know, but you need to know, FabFitFun is a women's lifestyle subscription box, and every time you get one, it's full of full-size premium beauty, lifestyle, fitness, home, and wellness products. They send it right to your doorstep every single season. I love these boxes. It's like my birthday and Christmas all together. But anyhow, when I get the boxes, I rush it up to my bedroom. I lock the door. I make sure nobody's around because I don't want my cats around harassing me. I don't want my daughters around trying to poach my FabFitFun stuff. And I do an unboxing. I usually make a videotape of it, and this time I did because I just got my FabFitFun fall box last week, and oh my gosh, I love the products in it. A couple of things I got. I got the Cosmetics Pure C Vitamin C Mixing Crystals. I'll be honest, I was like, what is this? I have never seen that before in my life. It's this tiny little case full of vitamin C. It's like a powder, and you can mix it with any kind of whatever skin product you use, whatever you use to moisturize your face. A couple of shakes of the powder, mix it up with your moisturizer, put it on your skin for brighter, smoother skin. I love it. I love that I can mix it with anything I already have. Another thing that came in my box, and I did a triple take when I saw this, was an Anthropologie travel yoga mat. People, Anthropologie is usually outside of my budget, but this came in my FabFitFun box. I love it. It's a perfect yoga mat that travels. It folds up into this tiny little package. It's so cushiony and just, I mean, and hello, it's Anthropologie. And I also got, and this is gonna be perfect for fall evenings, cozy evenings, once my kids go to sleep, I love to sit down with a cup of chai and have some snacks. I have this beautiful gourmet wood and ceramic cheese board gift set. It's a little gift set, but this gift is for me. It's by Twine Living Company. I love it. It's perfect for just a personal snack, and I'm gonna be using that cheese board all through the fall. Now look, the FabFitFun boxes go really fast. Right now, the fall box is on sale, and before you know it, they will run out of it. So sign up for yours today. Look, all the FabFitFun boxes retail for $49.99, but they always have a value of over $200. Like that Anthropologie travel yoga mat I talked about, that's $50 by itself. And the Cosmetics Vitamin C powder, I mean, that retails for almost $40. So yeah, you're gonna get so much more than you pay for with your FabFitFun boxes. And it's honestly just so much fun. I love it as a gift for myself. I have gotten FabFitFun subscriptions as gifts for my friends. The holidays are around the corner. I'm telling you, this subscription box is one of my favorite things. So use the coupon code UNDISCLOSED and get $10 off your first box, which means it's only gonna be $39.99 by going to www.fabfitfun.com. Once again, go to www.fabfitfun.com and use the coupon code UNDISCLOSED for $10 off your first box.
Even at trial, though, there appeared to be some serious issues with the state's case. Let's start with Rodriguez Lee. Casey Wilson, who is now Cyrus Wilson's wife, was in the courtroom for Cyrus's trial.
And as you say, you're in the courtroom and you're hearing these other really kids testifying against him at trial, saying he's guilty. Did that give you any pause and reason to question whether he was guilty at the time when you were there at the trial?
It did not, because they actually didn't say it. They were led to say just about everything they said. So there was never like a question of, actually one of the guys, Rodriguez, when he was testifying, he started out and they were like, you know, did you see him? And he was like, no. Were you there? No. Like, he's answering these questions and the DA gets really frustrated with him. And so she's like, she has the jury go out. She asked for a jury out. And so while the jury is not in there, she goes to him and she's like, so this isn't what we discussed in my office. This isn't what we were discussing, you know. And instead of the judge, I was thinking, you know, why isn't the judge now? I'm like, why wouldn't the judge interject at that point and say, okay, well, this is what he's testifying to. You know, like, you can't make him change his testimony because it's not fitting your narrative now, you know, regardless of what you discussed in your office. you know, he's in court now. You can't make him change his testimony, which didn't happen. So she basically called the jury back in and led him through a narrative that they had created in her office, and he agreed to it. He just agreed and said, yes, yes, yes. You know, he never actually gave detailed information. You know, it was basically she asked him a lot of leading questions, and he agreed to those questions.
And that's not the only problem with Rodriguez Lee. At trial, it came out that his first police statement was quite different from his testimony at trial. In that first statement, Lee claimed that Cyrus wasn't the only one pursuing Christopher Luckett the night of the murder. Instead, he claimed that Cyrus was accompanied by Benji Amos, the brother of Cyrus's girlfriend, Lasonia. But that couldn't be right because Benji was in a juvenile detention center on September 15th. At trial, Lee would claim that he lied about Benji being there because he didn't want to be the only other person who was present for the murder. And then there was Will Birch, who was dispatched to the scene of the shooting and drove Christopher Luckett's body to the morgue. Now recall that Marquise Harris said he had seen the shooting from his bedroom window. According to Birch, though, the area around Luckett was not well lit, and he could only see what was immediately next to him. And Birch also testified that Harris's apartment complex was about a football field away from the scene of the shooting, and that he couldn't even see it from the area where Luckett's body was located. But again, it didn't matter. At the end of the trial, the jury found Cyrus Wilson guilty of the murder of Christopher Luckett.
Significant to me, like nothing. Like it didn't matter what someone said to me about the witnesses or who was testifying. Like I had no reason to care. Like at the end of the day, my mindset was I was going home. Like, I don't care how much they play this out or what they're doing. I think probably the only shocking thing to me was that I was convicted. Like, that's when I was probably like, okay, what the hell is going on? Like, in my brain, that was probably the thing where, and even then, I don't know. I remember coming, telling my wife about my, you know, being convicted and being like, she knew she was at the trial. But I'm just saying, I remember, like, calling her and, like, you know, what was, like, I had that conversation that, you know, right after my trial, and, like, I don't know, I think in my head, I still felt like I was going to beat this, like, even, like, I think there was a point where my lawyer was like, well, you're not going to be in jail for long, like, you will appeal, you'll get out.
Cyrus Wilson would initially go that appeal alone. Cyrus's trial was the first criminal trial for his attorney, who would be suspended soon after Cyrus's trial based upon misconduct.
The situation with my lawyer at the time was really nuts. He was already having some court issues, and like he ended up being suspended like, what, maybe 35 days after my trial, like literally 35 days. I got convicted, I think, on the 1st of February. By the March 10th, his license had already been suspended and taken away from him.
According to Cyrus's appeal, at the time of Cyrus's trial, his attorney was, quote, undergoing an emotional, psychological, and or alcohol drug dependency evaluation by a mental health and treatment center. A few years after trial, Cyrus's attorney would eventually be disbarred. Meanwhile, Cyrus was able to obtain an attorney to represent him in connection with his petition for post-conviction relief. That petition raised some seemingly viable claims, such as the claim that his trial counsel was ineffective based on failing to contact two alibi witnesses from the basketball court who could have testified they were with Cyrus when the shots were fired. But I've read through the court filings in this appeal and reviewed the evidence presented, and both are oddly lacking. It's not hard to see why the judge denied Cyrus a new trial. It's also not hard to see why, like Cyrus's trial counsel, Cyrus's post-conviction counsel was later disbarred. Nonetheless, Cyrus didn't give up, and eventually he was able to uncover a key document from the prosecutor's file.
First of all, there was a letter. Like, That's what kind of prompted the whole thing. So we went, I got the DA's, the district attorney's file, and in the file, the assistant DA that prosecuted me, Kimberly Hathaway, she had put in her file and her resume the fact that she knew all the witnesses had lied repeatedly. In notations on that paperwork was Rodriguez Lee and Marquise Harris's name. Both of them, they both might have been in juvenile facilities, but both of their names was on the document. So in this document, she says that I had, you know, repeatedly said that I was innocent of the crimes, that I had nothing to do with it, and she said that she knew that the witnesses had lied to her repeatedly. So that's how I got back in court.
Now, at this point, you might be thinking this is a clear Brady violation, with the prosecution failing to disclose to the defense that the key witnesses against Cyrus had lied repeatedly. But the Tennessee courts held this document was what's known as work product, or privileged, and thus inadmissible information containing the prosecutor's thoughts about the case. This conclusion is questionable, but what's clear is this document led to contacting the juvenile witnesses in Cyrus's case.
The stuff that happened with the recantments all came, I don't know, as a result of me fighting the case. I guess they, you know, if Rodriguez, how Rodriguez came about, I have a friend, we have a, well, I don't want to say a mutual friend, I guess they're friends, but my friend, who is Chris Pope, has kids by Rodriguez's sister. So because of that, he was always kind of in contact with Rodriguez, or I guess could have, but I hadn't kept in contact with Chris. So like when I eventually did talk to him, like around the time that Rodriguez would recant, you know, he just commented to me that Rodriguez felt like, you know, he was young and he was misled and, you know, forced to give his testimony or whatever. So I was like, that was kind of shocking to me.
On October 19th, 2010, Rodriguez Lee would sign an affidavit that stated the following. The affiant states that his testimony at trial was not true. The affiant did not observe Cyrus Wilson on the evening of the alleged killing. Furthermore, the affiant did not observe Cyrus Wilson shoot and kill anyone. The affiant did not see Cyrus Wilson with a shotgun on the night that Christopher Luckett was killed. The affiant was 13 years old at the time he was first interviewed by detectives in this matter. The affiant resided with his mother, Nieta White. The detectives came into his home and placed handcuffs on the affiant. The detective stated to the affiant that he was going to be arrested for murder in the first degree. The detectives began to question the affiant regarding the death of Christopher Luckett. The affiant denied any knowledge of the death of Luckett. The detectives then asked the affiant about Cyrus Wilson. They explained the evidence against Cyrus Wilson and the murder scene. The detectives told the affiant they needed him to tell them about what he saw at the scene, and then the affiant would not be arrested. The affiant's mother then said he needed to tell them whatever he knew. The affiant then told the detectives what he believed they wanted to hear. This was not truthful. A few years later, the other two key teenage witnesses against Cyrus Wilson would also recant. Frederick Davis signed an affidavit saying he'd never heard Cyrus say he was going to get Christopher Luckett. According to Davis, he'd only testified about hearing this statement because right before he testified, the prosecutor showed him an article saying that Cyrus was going to get Luckett. And then there was Marquise Harris, who testified to seeing the murder from his window. According to Harris, "So now, after living with this burden for almost 25 years, I'm therefore coming forward with this sworn affidavit as a witness recanting my trial testimony and any other testimony or statements I made against Mr. Cyrus D. Wilson in case 93A-176 because it's false. I do not know Mr. Wilson or the alleged victim in the case, nor did I see Mr. Wilson shoot and kill the alleged victim. The only reason I know of this case is because I was explained the details by the detective in ADA. I will testify to these facts before the court if necessary." But that's not the only thing that came up in connection with Marquise Harrison appeal. That other thing was Crime Stoppers money. When Detective Bill Pridemore approached Harris, Harris didn't merely request Crime Stoppers money, he demanded it before he would disclose any information about the case. Moreover, Harris got the Crime Stoppers money. Kind of. Harris and his friend came up with a plan pursuant to which Harris gave his friend the Crime Stoppers code so that he could collect the money. This explains why the issue of Crime Stoppers money didn't come up at any trial. But it did come up in appeal, with Cyrus's attorney claiming that, quote, "This would be much more compelling on cross than a situation where a witness comes forward, provides credible evidence, and then is given a reward without request. But here, Mr. Harris demanded the reward." At trial, Marquise Harris simply testified that Pridemore asked him for information, and he, Harris, answered his questions. Second, Mr. Harris was still a child at this time. Any reward given to a child would have had much greater significance than an adult that was able to earn money. Are you looking to freshen up your snack game? Well, Perfect Snacks is the coolest in the game. They have a whole lineup of fresh-from-the-fridge protein snacks that you and your whole family will love. Perfect Snacks' line of fresh-from-the-fridge protein bars are made with freshly ground nut butter, up to 17 grams of whole food protein, and 20 superfoods, all combined to create a cookie dough-like texture that is just as nutritious as it is delicious. With delicious flavors like dark chocolate peanut butter, almond butter, coconut peanut butter, you won't have to sacrifice taste for health. All Perfect Snacks products are first of its kind and kept refrigerated for optimal texture and taste.
and stay fresh for up to 1 week out of the fridge. Perfect to take on the go, wherever you need a snack, and to help avoid any meltdowns. In addition to tasting good, these bars will help you feel good because they're non-GMO, project verified, gluten-free, soy-free, kosher, low GI, and made in the USA. Now, I started the school year a couple weeks ago, and I've been having Perfect Snacks dark chocolate peanut butter bar right before my afternoon class when my energy is waning. They're delicious, and they give me the energy I need for the rest of the workday. And right now, Perfect Bar is offering you 15% off your online order. Just go to perf.bar/undisclosed. Shop the refrigerated snacks at perf.bar/undisclosed today to get 15% off your first order. Make your day a little more perfect at perf.bar/undisclosed. All of this evidence connected to the three juvenile witnesses sounds a lot like the Central Park 5 case, and it explains why Cyrus's wife, Casey, was so hopeful that he would be released.
I was like, well, you know, this is amazing. I was excited. I was like, okay, this is finally going to be over. Like, you know, he's finally going to come home. You know, things are, you know, looking up. And then, you know, of course, court is not cut and dry. Like, you know, and I think a lot of people feel that way. I think a lot of people feel like, oh, if you're innocent, this would never happen. If you're innocent, you're not going to go to jail. If you're innocent, you know, they're not going to arrest you if you're innocent. If you're innocent, they're definitely not going to send you to prison. And, you know, now we know that that happens a lot to a lot of people.
In the end, as in so many other cases, the witness recantations were not enough to win Cyrus Wilson a new trial. Nor were two new, interrelated types of evidence. The first related to Rodriguez Lee's claim that Cyrus had gotten the sawed-off shotgun that he used to shoot Christopher Luckett out of the trunk of the Chevy Bel Air that he had driven to the scene of the murder. Well, as you might have remembered, this claim didn't make any sense because the Bel Air was inoperable after it had been returned to Cyrus after the robbery. But trial counsel never called Cyrus's aunt Wanda Polk a trial. Polk would later submit an affidavit that the Bel Air had been taken to her place before the murder because it would have been towed if it remained at Cyrus's place, and it remained there through the day that Luckett was shot. Another affidavit was written by Polk's son, Rasheem Williams, and this affidavit could be the key to this case. Williams' affidavit states the police came to his place looking for the shotgun that might have been used by Cyrus in the murder. Now, Cyrus did have a shotgun. He doesn't dispute that, but he claims the shotgun was in the trunk of the Bel Air at his aunt's place on the night of the murder. And in his affidavit, Williams says that when the police came, he retrieved the shotgun from the trunk and gave it to them. The state subpoenaed Williams, but did not call him as a witness at trial. And there might be a reason for that. Detective Bill Pridemore submitted a shotgun for testing by the Tennessee Bureau of Investigations. And that testing determined the shotgun at issue did not fire the shotgun shells recovered from the area where Christopher Luckett was killed. This sounds huge and sounds like exculpatory evidence. Except for the fact the paperwork connected to the shotgun is weird. According to that paperwork, Detective Pridemore was informed that two patrol officers were pursuing a young African-American male who dropped a shotgun in the area near where the Luckett murder occurred. And according to Pridemore, this was the shotgun he submitted to the TBI for testing. But the young man dropped the shotgun on November 22nd, well after Cyrus was arrested and the primary suspect in Christopher Luckett's case. And there's no indication in the paperwork of why Pridemore thought this shotgun was connected to the murder. Understandably, this is all very troubling to Cyrus Wilson.
Because they had my gun, like you're talking about evidence, they eventually got what they thought was the murder weapon, and the TBI crime lab proved that the gun was not the murder weapon. And so apparently they put some paperwork in my file that said that they got the gun from somewhere else, not actually from my cousin, Rasheem Williams. And then, like, so me and my wife tried to go downtown and trace the gun back because I was like, well, if they're trying to say they found it at such and such, when they actually turned the gun in, there would be no need to try to, like, there had to be a chain of command, like, in terms of paperwork and saying that, we got this gun, this is what it was for, Cyrus Wilson, da-da-da. Then when it gets tested, I was like, they wouldn't have known they had to lie until after it got tested and they realized, oh, this is not even a damn murder weapon, like, we got to do something different. And so when we try to trace it back, there is, in the evidence downtown for the police department, there is no trace of the gun. Like, no, nothing. I had to give the lady the serial number. She's like, as far as she can tell, an archive, computer, nothing. She's like, there is no nothing that says, no record that this gun has ever been in our custody.
Did you know that on average, it takes police 45 minutes to respond to a home security alarm? Almost an hour. When a home security system is triggered, a lot of the time police assume it's a false alarm and the call goes to the bottom of the list. But not with SimpliSafe Home Security. SimpliSafe has video verification technology, which helps police get on the scene up to 3.5 times faster. SimpliSafe can visually confirm that a break-in is happening, giving police precise information about where an intruder is in the home and whether they're armed. So they have all the information they need to get there faster and catch a criminal ASAP. SimpliSafe also protects every door, window, and room with 24/7 professional monitoring. They make it easy on you. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. Price is always fair and honest, and around-the-clock monitoring starts at just $15 a month. It's won a ton of awards from CNET to the New York Times Wirecutter. And I can say personally, I've used SimpliSafe for the past few years, and I've never felt safer. And now for my listeners, SimpliSafe has a huge deal going on right now. Go to simplysafeundisclosed.com and get free shipping and a money-back guarantee. That's simplysafeundisclosed.com today. simplysafeundisclosed.com. So was this a case of bait and switch, police negligence, or something else? Unfortunately, we can't say anything conclusive. And yet again, this means the evidence connected to the shotgun was not enough to award Cyrus Wilson a new trial. So where does that leave him? It leaves him with the possibility of being paroled. Back in April, Cyrus had a hearing before Tennessee Board of Parole member Gay Gregson. And this brings us back to the problem identified in the introduction, the innocent prisoner's dilemma. I spoke with Daniel Medwed, University Distinguished Professor of Law and Criminal Justice at the Northeastern University School of Law, about this dilemma.
So basically, the whole idea of parole emerged, as you probably know, in the 19th century, and it was part of the medical model of prisons that was also based a little bit on sort of 19th century religious ideology, that prisoners are sick and that they can become cured through proper treatment in the institution. The whole idea of a penitentiary, of course, is a penitent, someone who is repenting. And the key part about parole, really from its genesis, was this idea that you have to acknowledge your guilt. If you acknowledge your guilt, then that's the first step on the path to improvement. And it's very much sort of a Judeo-Christian idea of confession. Once you confess, you cleanse your soul. Once your soul is clean, only then can you make amends and sort of move forward and be a better person. And parole is this idea that, once you've been cleansed, once you've demonstrated through your time in prison that, you're a penitent, that you have repented and acknowledged your indiscretions, that you're no longer much of a public safety risk. And that 19th century ideology still basically undergirds the entire approach to parole. We talk about recidivism risks, we talk about what your disciplinary record was in prison, but to a large extent, whether you accept responsibility, and a lot of jurisdictions use that term, acceptance of responsibility or expression of remorse, that's sort of the key to getting out on parole, which is an act of grace. So what does this mean for an innocent prisoner? Well, if you haven't done the crime, you can't accept responsibility for something you didn't do. And even though you can express empathy for what happened to a victim, you can't really express remorse. Remorse is the idea that you've done something wrong and you feel badly about it. And if you haven't done anything wrong, then remorse is a difficult concept as well. So here's the dilemma. If a prisoner, innocent prisoner, sticks to his or her guns, claims to be innocent, fails to accept responsibility, that greatly diminishes the chance of being released on parole. But if you admit guilt falsely, if you admit guilt, accept responsibility to maximize your chance on parole, with the idea that later, once you're out, you can try to overturn your conviction through the courts, then you're sinking your chance of doing well in litigation, because now there's an admission of guilt on your record, which you're an evidence expert, Colin, as you know, is going to be admissible as a party admission in any subsequent post-conviction proceeding.
So
So obviously, the fact that Cyrus Wilson continues to maintain his innocence makes it more difficult for him to obtain parole. That said, there are several other factors that weigh in his favor. First, the Vanderbilt Prison Project, a student group at Vanderbilt, has become involved in this case and sent more than 100 students to his parole hearing. I spoke with Jennifer Pidge, the president of the project, about her group's involvement in Cyrus's case.
One of the primary principles of our organization is to try to center the voices and humans who are most impacted by this system. So something that's very important to us in any work that we do is that we're as closely connected as possible to the actual people who are involved and what they actually want. So for us, having an opportunity to, I had coffee with Casey yesterday, to meet quite often with his family. I've gotten to meet Cyrus a couple of times and make sure that what we are doing is what they want us to be doing and be closely connected to the family themselves. It's very important to us. So I think the opportunity to get engaged in a local case here, which we felt was important for Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt students kind of exist in a bubble where they don't really know a lot about what's going on. In Nashville, it's really easy to live your life on this campus and not engage with anything off campus. So for us to be able to explain to Vanderbilt students that we have a stake in Cyrus's freedom, he's our community member, our community needs him to be free. And so we have a responsibility to be a part of that case because we are Nashville citizens. All of the things I think that influenced us wanting to get involved with this.
Second, Cyrus has Raheem Buford. The two met in prison before Buford was paroled, and he went on to found Unheard Voices Outreach to empower incarcerated and formerly incarcerated persons to be leaders in reentry. Buford testified on Cyrus's behalf at his parole hearing.
When Cyrus is released, he's not just coming out. There's a community of people waiting for him. When Cyrus is released, I have no doubt in my mind that he's going to be successful. He's not a threat to society. Cyrus has demonstrated that he can live a positive, respectful life. As you mentioned, he has not had a disciplinary report in the last 9 years.
Third, Cyrus has his wife, Casey, who has stood by his side throughout the years. She also testified at Cyrus's parole hearing.
Our daughters need Cyrus home. Even though he is not their biological father, he has stepped in and became their dad. They are at a pivotal moment in their lives where they are transitioning from adolescence to adulthood, and they need their father's guidance on a daily basis. Our girls have an undeniable connection that is apparent to anyone who sees them interact with their father. They love him and visit him regularly, but that will never fill the void that having their father in their home on a daily basis would fill. Having their father home means not waiting on a phone call to let him know about acing a test or making the cheerleading team. Having their father home means him being present at their recitals, their dance competitions, their graduations, their proms. We are all here to offer our strength to help Cyrus in whatever he needs to transition back into society. And we're asking that you grant him parole. Thank you.
Fourth, Cyrus gave his own powerful testimony at his hearing.
By granting me parole, I hope the board would recognize you not only take a chance on me and my future, but you take a chance on an entire community that has already come to know me and learn the value of my character and my personality as a man that they can trust to be a positive and productive member of our society. As a young boy and teenager, I can easily see how my choices could lead to a place where my arrest and conviction was possible. No parts of that person exist in me today. Today I'm a mature man who has a zest for life. I am a husband, a father, a grandfather, and a valued member of our society inside and out. I am a man who fully understands the consequences of his actions, and I believe I am an ideal candidate to be released on parole.
But will any of it be enough with Cyrus maintaining his innocence? I spoke with Daniel Medwed about how parole boards should treat claims of innocence.
Do, and I've written letters. I've been I've been asked to provide assistance to a number of prisoners facing this dilemma over the years. And what I typically do is I write a letter to the board, basically saying you should just discount any statements of guilt or innocence. Your role isn't to reinvestigate the case. We get that. That's for the courts. You don't have the resources to necessarily investigate it. All I would suggest is that in considering whether somebody should be free on parole, just discount those statements of guilt or innocence, because there's reason to think that they're not credible either way. So, for instance, there are lots of crocodile tears of remorse from factually guilty people. Everyone knows the drill. The prison grapevine is pretty efficient on this. Everyone knows that the parole board wants to hear remorse. They want to hear acceptance of responsibility. They want to hear expressions of empathy. That doesn't mean that those expressions are necessarily genuine. I mean, I strongly suspect that a lot of people who are released on parole are possibly the best actors as opposed to the most remorseful. So what I would urge the board to do is just discount it. Take into account the idea that maybe the claim of innocence is credible. Not that you have to investigate it, not that you have to necessarily credit it, but at least acknowledge that it's a possibility and not hold it against Mr. Wilson.
So is that what will be done by the Tennessee Board of Parole in Cyrus's case? It's not clear, but what Board Member Gay Gregson said at the end of Cyrus's hearing sounds reasonably promising.
I want us to remember again, what was the name of the victim?
Christopher Luckett.
Christopher Luckett, and I don't want him to get lost in the shuffle here because he was a 19-year-old young man who was murdered by somebody. And I don't have any kind of litmus test that says you have to confess in order to be able to get out, because I know there's been high profile cases where innocent people have been convicted and gone to prison. So that's not a litmus test. But my vote is going to be that we continue this hearing for 6 months.
Is that how long we do it?
Yeah, for six months, so that you will be offered the strong R again, and then that you go and have a psychological to determine the propensity to reoffend. You know, I do believe that when somebody is 3 days past their 18th birthday, That's really, really young, and you have been locked up a long time. But there's just more information that I have to have before I would be willing to vote to let you out. And I don't want to vote to deny you. So that's going to be my vote. Do you have any questions about my vote?
No, ma'am. Thank you for your time.
Cyrus recently had a psychological evaluation, and he'll appear before Gregson again in October. At that point, Gregson will write a report recommending whether parole should be granted or denied. There are 7 members of the Tennessee Board of Parole, and it takes 4 yes votes for Cyrus to be granted parole. When that vote takes place, we'll be sure to provide you with an update. Thanks so much for listening to this special addendum episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Christy Williams and Nina Musser for website management, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mital Telhan, our executive producer. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedpod.